Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. It was wonderful to be with you on a Wednesday afternoon. Today is the 21st day of the month of Cheshvan in the Hebrew calendar, the 12th of November. So let's look at this week's milestones in the Hebrew calendar. Some very interesting things come up, and then we'll discuss some fascinating ideas. So let's go start out with Sunday. Sunday was the 18th of Cheshvan. 18th of Cheshvan is the anniversary of the Madagascar Plan. In 1938, Reich Marshal Hermann Göring told the German cabinet that they were going forward with the Madagascar Plan. The plan was that all Jews in Europe would be exiled to the island off the southeastern coast of Africa. In 1939, the plan was even included in a peace proposal to the Pope. Seeing as the island was a French colony, the project didn't go anywhere until France surrendered to Germany in 1940. In July of that year, the plan was formalized. In the plan, France would give Madagascar to Germany. The Jews would be forced to move there and would have to finance the move themselves. The colony would remain under the control of an SS police force. Hitler expected to quickly defeat Britain, and then he would repurpose the vanquished Royal Navy to transport the Jews there at a rate of 1 million per year. When the engagement with Britain took longer than expected and the Nazis attacked the USSR, the plan became unfeasible. The Madagascar plan was then replaced, of course, with the final solution to the Jewish problem, better known as the Holocaust the Shoah. Most historians agree that had the ambitious Madagascar plan become a reality, most of the Jews sent there would have likely perished due to tropical disease and abuse and murder by the Nazi captors. Okay, so let's move on. So Monday was the 19th of Cheshvan, this past Monday, and was the anniversary of the completion of the Mishneh Berurah in 1906. The Mishneh Berurah was completed by Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan HaKohen, known to the world as the Chofetz Chaim. The Mishneh Berurah has been the most influential Jewish book written in the past 500 years since the publishing of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch by Rabbi Yosef Karo codified Jewish law in the early 16th century. The six-volume Mishneh Berurah covers the daily living section of the Shulchan Aruch, which is called Orach Chaim. It brings in all the major opinions from the 400 years between the two monumental works and tells which one is the authoritative position, which one we follow, which is the Ashkenazi custom to observe. The Mishneh Berurah is not only a staple in every Jewish library, but many have a daily study session in the book, and it's a clear handbook as how to live as a Jew. There is a wonderful program called Dirshu. Dirshu is an organization started by Rabbi David Hofstetter, who's from Toronto in Canada, and he created a wonderful initiative. I'm sure everybody's heard of Daf Yomi, where everybody learns the same Daf around the world, the same page in Gemara. So he came up with the Daf Yomi Bahalocha program, Rabbi Hofstetter, through Dirshu, and it encourages people to learn a page of Mishneh Berurah every day. It's 5 days a week. And it's an absolutely wonderful program. Many communities in Johannesburg have a daily Mishneh Berurah shir. My community included also Sunny Road Kehillah, and we have our shir every morning after davening. And it really is an unbelievable program to learn this wonderful sefer of the Chofetz Chaim. And where would we be today without the Chofetz Chaim and without the Mishneh Berurah? It really lights the way for Jewish observance and tells us what opinions we follow and what the halacha is. It is an essential and classic work that the Chofetz Chaim wrote on Monday, the 19th of Cheshvan, 1906. Okay, let's move on. Today is the 21st of Cheshvan. Today is the Yotzeit of the Radvaz, Rav David Ibn Abi Zimra, known as the Radvaz. The Radvaz was born in Spain. After being exiled in 1492, he went to Eretz Israel. He was only in Israel for a short time, though due to the difficult economic conditions, he couldn't stay in Israel. After a year, he left and eventually became chief rabbi of Egypt. There he opened a great yeshiva that catered to such illustrious students as Rav Yitzhak Luria, the Arizal, the father of modern-day Kabbalah. The Radvaz was a prolific writer and penned over 3,000 responsa. In one of his more famous letters, the Radvaz was asked about the Beta Israel community in Ethiopia. The Beta Israel was a community in Ethiopia that claimed to be Jewish. The group had been cut off from the rest of the Jewish world for centuries and therefore had developed many laws and customs that differed from mainstream Judaism. His position was that if they were to accept traditional rabbinic Judaism, they would be welcomed back into the community. This opinion was upheld by Rav Avraham Yitzhak HaKohen Cook, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel. The Prime Minister Menachem Begin obtained a clear ruling from Rav Ovadia Yosef, the chief Sephardi rabbi in Israel, who applied the Radvaz's logic. In 1973, this position was used as a basis to start rescuing Ethiopian Jews from their war-torn country. And due to this sack of the Radvaz, they were brought into Israel. They were accepted and regarded as legitimate, their claim to be Jewish and their absorption into Israeli society, which is an amazing thing. So it was based on the ruling of the Radvaz, and his Yotzeit is today. Okay, so let's carry on. Tomorrow is the 22nd of Cheshvan, and it is the anniversary in 1944 of the day the Nazis resumed deportation of the Budapest Jewish community. There were some 750,000 Jews in Hungary before the war, of which only 30% survived. Many of those who were saved survived through the work of Raoul Wallenberg. Wallenberg was sent by Sweden to Budapest during the war as its special envoy to rescue Jews. He issued protective passports to tens of thousands of Jews and hid them in buildings designated as Swedish territory. During the siege of Budapest by the Red Army, Wallenberg was taken as a Soviet prisoner on suspicion of espionage and never heard from again. Records that have since been made public do reveal that he was an American asset. Tremendous efforts have been made to find out the truth about what happened to Raoul Wallenberg. Accounts range from his dying of either natural causes or execution in 1947 to still being alive 3 decades later and everything in between. Regardless, he's remembered today through momentous honorary citizenship, street naming, and as one of the righteous among the nations by the State of Israel. Interestingly, his niece was the wife of the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Okay, and there's one more date that I want to make reference to, and that is this coming Shabbos. So this coming Shabbos is the 24th of Cheshvan, and it is actually the Yotzeit of Baron Edmund de Rothschild. So in a moment, when we come back from the break, we'll discuss who Baron Edmund de Rothschild was and his unbelievable contribution to the Jewish people, this coming Shabbos being his 91st Yotzeit. So please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
This coming Shabbos, the 24th of Cheshvan, is the Yotzeit of Baron Edmund de Rothschild. But before we discuss him, let's discuss Dischem. Sorry, one sec. Okay, here we go. Dischem Wellness Clinic for adults offers convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks whether you're having your regular wellness checks such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Diskin Wellness Clinic offers you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning and pregnancy screening, fast, affordable, and with care. Find your nearest Diskin Wellness Clinic inside Diskin Pharmacy's Better Health Starts Here. So Baron Edmund de Rothschild was born in 1845. We know the Rothschild Empire dynasty was vast and extremely successful. It was started by Anshul Mayer Rothschild. And Anshul Mayer had five sons, and he had the very smart idea of sending each of those sons to a capital in Europe. And they started international banking and build a massive financial empire. Because up until that point, banking was all local. If you were in England and you wanted to invest your money, you couldn't do it in France because you didn't speak the language and you didn't trust them in France. These countries were always at war. But if you had a banker whose brother was in France and he could be trusted, so that opened the way to international banking, which had never been done on that scale before. And so there were brothers. There's a brother in Naples. There was a brother in Vienna. There was a brother in Frankfurt. There was a brother in Paris. And there was a brother in London. The brother in London was Nathan. He was an observant Jew, didn't do any business on Shabbos. The brother in Frankfurt was William, also an observant Jew, who was a big supporter of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. The brother in France was James, and he assimilated. However, he did insist that his children and grandchildren should not intermarry or should not convert out of Judaism. Now, his son was Edmund. So Edmund was a third generation of assimilated Jews. It was his grandson. So Edmund was James's grandson. And he was the third generation of assimilated Jews, of Rothschilds in France. And at the age of 29 years old, he inherited the French branch of the empire with billions of dollars. And he was not particularly motivated or interested in becoming a banker, in running the bank, which is often the case of children and grandchildren of very wealthy families. And that's how all these foundations start. They're interested in sharing the money. And that's how we have the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Ford Foundation, et cetera, et cetera. So he was looking for a cause, Baron Edmund. And there was a Jew in Poland. He was the Rav in Bialystok. His name was Rav Shmuel Moaleva. And he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He was the executive director of the Chovevei Tzion, which was started in Volozhin. And he went to see the Baron. He heard about him, and he went to him. It's a very unlikely match. He didn't speak French. The Baron didn't speak Yiddish. Yet in 1882, he convinces the Baron about this wild scheme to find new settlements of Jews returning to the land of Israel who would work the land. And he said to him, "You give us the money, and I'll give you the people." And the Baron built 39 new settlements. And today, many of them are major cities in Israel. For example, Rishon LeZion, Zichron Yaakov. Yaakov is after his grandfather James. Binyamina, because his name is Binyamin. Rehovot, Machzeret Batya. Batya was his mother. Givat Ada, his wife was Adele. And Binyamina, as we said, we mentioned, and Pardes Chana. Chana was his auntie. So these are just some of the settlements that he funded. He spent over $50 million, which you can imagine how much it was in those days, 150 years ago. And he also funded a wine company called Carmel Mizrahi, Carmel of the East, because there was Carmel in France, and he called this Carmel Mizrahi. Carmel West was France. And the first bottle made by Carmel was sent to the Netziv by the Baron, and the nephew of the Netziv, the Baruch HaLevi Epstein, the author of the Torah Tamim and Makor Baruch, he writes that bottle, when it arrived in Volozhin, the Netziv went to receive it wearing his Shabbos clothes. to honor a bottle of wine that came from Eretz Yisrael, which all the mitzvot tullios ba'aretz had been fulfilled in that bottle of wine. So the Baron obviously made a massive contribution to the Jewish people and to the return to the land of Israel. So as we know, there were always Jews in the land of Israel, but as the pogroms of the 19th century intensified further, so many Jews from Europe wanted to return back to Israel to join their brothers and sisters in Israel. And but there was no money. It was there was no economy in Israel. It was run by the Ottoman Empire. It was a economic desolate wasteland. And so the Baron put up the money to fund many of these settlements. He died in 1934 at the age of 39. He was buried in an estate overlooking the Mediterranean. His body was reinterred in 1953. It's called Ramat HaNadiv. And this is what he wrote. This is what Ben-Gurion wrote. This is what David Ben-Gurion said as a eulogy when they reinterred his body in 1953. Ben-Gurion said, "I doubt that in the entire history of the Jewish people, in the diaspora over 2,000 years, one could find a man like Baron Edmund the Rothschild, the builder of the Yeshuv, in our renewal to our homeland." He wrote an ethical will, the Baron, and he said, "I thank the God of Israel to be part of the returning of the people of Israel to the land of Israel." His son dedicated the building of the Knesset in his father's honor. So he paid for the building of the Knesset, building that Knesset uses today. And also the Supreme Court was built by the son of Baron Rothschild and the National Library. So we see his contribution was immense. And although he was a assimilated Jew, he saw at the end of his life the great value of having contributed and being part of the return and strengthening of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And it's something we should all learn from. We should all play our part in strengthening the Jewish people, in strengthening our building of the land of Israel and the people of Israel and the dedication to the God of Israel. That should be the main focus of all of us in our lives. And the great example is of Baron Edmund the Rothschild, whose 91st Yotzat is coming up this Shabbos. Okay, let's talk a little bit now about the amazing lessons we learn from the weekly Torah readings. This week's Torah reading is Chayei Sarah, and it has in it so many powerful lessons. So let's see if we can share one or two in the short time that we have together. The Parsha opens up, interestingly enough, for you, Chayei Sarah, and these were the lives, this is the life of Sarah, Mea Shana, the Esrim Shana, the Sheva Shanim, says the Pasuk, that Sarah lived 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. Shnei Chayei Sarah were the years of the life of Sarah. So, of course, we know Sarah was the great matriarch. Her and her husband Abraham were the trailblazers. They started this enterprise of monotheism and taught the world about one God, a benevolent God, and the purpose of human beings is to connect to God and fulfill the will of God. And that is how the Jewish people were born, the mother and father of the Jewish people. Question is, why is it that when the Torah tells us about the years, about Sarah's life, that it expresses it in this way? It says 100 years and 20 years and 70 years. The Torah is very sparse with words. The Torah is very precise with words. Why didn't it just say 127 years, not 100 years and 20 years and 7 years? So Rashi tells us, I'm going to read Rashi to you. Lekach nichtav shana b'chol klal uklal. The reason why each time it said years, lo'im alecha shekol echad nidrash la'atzmo, to tell us that each of these different phases in Sarah's life is coming to teach us a lesson. Bas kuf kabas chaf lechet. When she was 100, she was like a 20-year-old with regards to sin. Ma bas chaf lo techeta, just as a 20-year-old does not sin. Sheharei eina bas onshin, because we know you only chayev min hashemayim for our veras from the age of 20 onwards. So when she was 20, when she was 100 years old, she was like a 20-year-old with regards to sin. In other words, she was free of sin. Such was her great character, and she was such a righteous woman. Af bas kuf belochet, bas chaf ke bas zayin liyofi, and continues Rashi, quoting the Bereshis Rabba, the Midrash, and she was, when she was 20, she was like a seven-year-old for beauty. So that's why it was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. So there's a big question we can ask on this Rashi, on this Midrash, and that is, firstly, this is the eulogy that the Torah is giving for Sarah. Of course, Sarah being one of the greatest human beings that ever lived, and the Torah is praising her for her greatness. And so one of the things it's pointing out is her beauty. Now, the Torah wants us to know that she was a beautiful woman, and we know that in this world, if somebody is impressive looking, is good looking, that, you know, people listen to them more. They can make more of an impression. That's just how we are as human beings. So the Torah is communicating to that Abraham and Sarah changed the world, literally changed the world. And Sarah was a beautiful woman, and that was part of her ability to impress people and to make her point being heard, to being a great spiritual example. So, however, the question goes still further. This is a eulogy. So I'm a rabbi. And part of what a rabbi does is, you know, they're different life cycle events, one of them being funerals, unfortunately, which are always very sad. And part of the job of the rabbi is to give a eulogy, is to give a hesped for the person who's passed away. Now, if I was giving a eulogy saying, you know, this woman was a very righteous person, she was a very kind person, she was a wonderful individual and helped so many around her, and I say, and she was gorgeous. So, you know, that probably would end my career as a rabbi. It's not appropriate to say such a thing as a rabbi. But it seems like the Torah is saying that, doesn't it? Torah is commenting on her beauty. So I heard a beautiful answer to this from Rabbi Friend in the name of the Yeshua's Malkel. Yeshua's Malkel says the following. That's the one question. The second question also we can ask is that a woman who's 20 is more beautiful than a woman who's 7. So it says she was beautiful at 20 like she was at 7. But isn't a 20-year-old more beautiful than a 7-year-old? So those are the two questions we can ask on this Midrash, on this Rashi. And Yeshua's Malkel has a wonderful answer. He says the following. He says that when somebody is beautiful, or when somebody is smart, or when somebody is wealthy, so all of these things really could go to one's head and could make a person quite arrogant and think that they are better and above others. And that's the point the Torah is making over here. The Torah is commenting on Sarah's beauty. She was beautiful at 20, like a 7-year-old, because her beauty was like a 7-year-old approaches beauty. A 7-year-old is innocent and is pure and is not arrogant and takes it in his or her stride. So such was Sarah. She was not an arrogant person. Her beauty was not something that made her feel that she was better and above and superior to others. On the contrary, it was something which she took with great humility and which was a quality which did not separate her from others, but rather endeared her to others. And that is a very powerful message and lesson, that if Hashem has blessed us with some ability, with some strength, with some great qualities, so it's very important that we work hard not to become arrogant as a result and remain humble like Sarah was. And, you know, within the Jewish world, we say we have great people. We call them Gedolim. Gedolim are great Torah scholars who have a tremendous understanding of the Torah. And some of them are known for their scholarship. Some of them are known for their kindness, some of them are known for their righteousness, for their tzidkus. But there's one common denominator in any great people within the Torah world, is they're all exceptionally humble. They all have that perspective of life, that they're not arrogant. And trust me, if I was a gadol, I would be a bit arrogant, because they know kol ha-Torah kulo. They know the whole Torah, which is, it's not normal, you know. It's only very gifted people and great geniuses have that tremendous knowledge and understanding and integration of the knowledge. It's a very unique and powerful thing. So all of them had that for sure, but none of them were arrogant, and none of them are arrogant. They are, although they know that they know the Kol HaTorah Kulo, most people don't, but nonetheless, they see a great understanding of their position, and they have a tremendous humility in the light of Hashem and Hashem's greatness. They're very, very humble people. There's an amazing story that I heard about Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was the Gadol HaDor, who lived in America after the war, and he was the Poisek HaDor. So all the big shilas, all the big questions and halachic issues in America post-Second World War went to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And he was highly respected, and he was just a phenomenal genius. His Igros Moshe is incredible. And there's a story that Rabbi Moshe was once walking on the street in New York, and somebody called out, "Hey, Moshe!" He was obviously calling somebody else in the street, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein turns around and says, "Yes." And like without any offense, without any issue, yeah, he's called Moshe. The person definitely wasn't calling him, he was calling somebody else. I mean, this was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, the Gadol HaDor, but he was so humble. Somebody called out Moshe, must be calling him, must be referring to him. So that is a very important quality of a great person that defines greatness. And that's what the Torah is telling us about Sarah Imenu, despite her tremendous spiritual achievements and her great beauty. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
So let's discuss another wonderful point we learned from Parshas Chayei Sarah. We see that Sarah passes away, Sarah dies, and now the baton is being handed to the next generation. And Abraham realizes that he needs to find a wife for Yitzchak. And Yitzchak and his wife would now carry on this great new approach to life, this wonderful teaching that Abraham and Sarah have brought to the world, that of monotheism, that of one God, and the beginnings of the Jewish people. So the Jewish people would be continued with Yitzchak and his wife. And so he understands, Abraham, that the people of Canaan, where they were, did not have the same attributes of chesed, of kindness, as the people of his hometown where he came from. And so he sends his trusted servant Eliezer to go and find a wife from Yitzhak, from the place where Abraham came from his own homeland. And he makes Eliezer swear. He makes Eliezer make an oath. Now, in past times, in ancient times, oaths were a very powerful means of telling the truth and of gaining commitment from an individual, because a person would swear in the name of God, and that was a very serious thing to do. Today, our word doesn't mean much. Even if we make an oath, we would easily negate it and easily contradict it, because today we are not so attached to truth as we should be. But in those days, they were, and so it was people took that very, very seriously, and therefore, if a person made an oath, it was an indication that they certainly would apply themselves to the maximum. And so Avram makes Eliezer swear. But the question is, the Shem Yishmol, the great Shem Yishmol, the great Hasidic Rebbe asks, the Rebbe of Sokachov, he says, why is it that Avram needs to make Eliezer swear? Eliezer had been his trusted servant for many, many decades. Eliezer was his 2IC. It says that Eliezer is Moishel Bebeisoy. He runs all of Avram's affairs in a very loyal and trustworthy way. So why is it at all necessary now? Suddenly, there's a new mission, there's a new task that his head of operations has to carry out, and now he makes him swear. But he hasn't done that ever before. So why was that necessary? Answers the Shem Yishmol a very beautiful insight into human nature. He says that as human beings, we often sell ourselves short. We have capacity, we have potential, we have ability, but when the going gets tough, we often want to back off and turn away and not push forward. That is normal human nature. The path of least resistance is the path that we're all going to choose. There's no question about it. And so Abraham wanted to impress upon Eliezer that there was no room for failure over here. It was the future of the Jewish people. It was the destiny of God's people and of the future of the world, and he had to get this job done. And even if the difficulty was immense, the stakes were so high that he had to push through it. And there was no option for failure. He had to succeed. He had to keep going. And so Abraham wanted Eliezer to know that, and he wanted to give him the ability to succeed by making him swear would enable Eliezer to succeed in the mission, which was not an easy mission. It would be a very difficult one and potentially had a lot of dangers and obstacles and pitfalls. But he wanted Eliezer to realize that failure is not an option. And it's such a great lesson in life for all of us, because how often is it that we do sell ourselves short and that we don't push through, we don't bring out our ability and our potential? It's something that we should be aware of and be conscious of, and we need to push ourselves in order to achieve our potential, not to give up, and to accomplish that which we are able to accomplish. And we see with great people live their lives in a way that they really apply themselves, and they get others around them to apply themselves, and that's how great things are achieved. And I think also, interestingly enough, that's why we say within human nature that communism doesn't work, because communism is a system where there's no personal incentive. There's wonderful general ideas of the equality of all human beings and of the equal income that is distributed amongst the masses. But when a person doesn't have personal incentive, so they back off and they chill out and they don't carry out what their great potential could be. And therefore, productivity drops tremendously. And that's why always we see the failure of communist systems. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
So we're discussing how Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, made an oath to go and find a wife for Yitzchak in Abraham's homeland, in where Abraham came from. And the pasuk says that Eliezer's concerned. He's worried. How's he going to achieve this? It's not going to be an easy task to find a wife from Abraham's family, because they're balei chesed, they're kind people, as opposed to the Knanim where they were and where Abraham was. And so he says to Hashem, "Hashem, help me." He makes a prayer to Hashem and almost a deal with Hashem. And he says, "Hashem, it's going to be hard for me. I need a son. I need your help." The person, the lady who offers me to drink and then offers my animals to drink, says, "I'll bring you water and I'll bring water for your animals." That'll be the one. I'll know that that's a sign that she's the right one. And as he finished saying that to Hashem, so the Torah tells us that he saw a young lady going to draw water. Now, remember, in those days, there was no running water. Everybody had to go to the wells to draw the water, to take home, and to for the animals to drink. And so the well was a meeting place of people. And it says that he ran towards her, Vayaratz ha'eved likrasa, that Eliezer ran in order to meet Rivka. And Rashi says, why did he run to meet her? It says, because Ra'a she elav hamayim likrasa, she alu hamayim likrasa. He saw that the water was coming up to her. In other words, she came down to the well and the water came towards her in a miraculous way. It wasn't normal. It was supernatural that this water now came towards this woman who was drawing the water. And he realized that obviously she's a special woman, that such a thing happens for her. And so that's why he went straight over to her, says Rashi, based on the Midrash. Rav Levi Yitzhak mi Berdichev, the Berdichev Rebbe, says an amazing thing. He asks a question. Actually, the Ramban asks the same question. He says, okay, so we see now the water is going towards Rivka when she comes to the water. But in just in a few verses' time, it says, V'tishav l'kol gemalav, that she actually does answer his request. In other words, understanding that Eliezer entered into with Hashem, that the one who the woman who offers me to drink and then also offers my animals to drink, I'll know she's the right one. And that's exactly what she does. She says, would you like to drink? And I'll also bring you water for your animals. But it says when she brought water for the animals, the pasuk says, v'tishav l'kol gemalav, that she had to go draw the water for the animals. So when she went to draw water for herself, the water came towards her. When she went to draw water for Eliezer and for his animals, she had to draw the water. So why is that? Why the change? It seems to, you know, what's going on over here? Either water did come up to her, didn't come up to her. But now when it was for her, it came up to her. When it wasn't for her, it didn't come up to her. Says Rev Levi Yitzhak, a beautiful, beautiful principle, a wonderful yesod. He says, Rivka was a righteous woman. And so Hashem wanted to make it easier and to facilitate her drawing the water, and so the water came towards her. That's when the water was for her. But now that she was engaged in a mitzvah, now that she was doing a chesed, a kindness, to give water to Eliezer and to give water to his animals, so the water didn't come up to her. She had to exert herself. She had to apply herself. She had to put in the effort. And says Rav Levi Yitzhak, such an important lesson and principle in spirituality, that sometimes we think the opposite. We think that, oh, wow, I'm doing a mitzvah. I'm doing a chesed. I'm doing Hashem's will. Hashem, help me out over here. Hashem, you know, make it easy for me. Pave the way for me, because I'm doing your command after all. So you should help me. That's usually our mindset. Says Rav Levi Yitzhak, we see from Rivka that that's incorrect. That's the wrong mindset. That even when we're doing a mitzvah, so often it won't go our way, and there are going to be obstacles, and there are going to be difficulties, and there are going to be challenges, and that is part of the process. Hashem gives us the opportunity to apply ourselves, to exert ourselves, to push ourselves in the fulfillment of the mitzvah, in the fulfillment of His will, and that's the way it's meant to be. So we shouldn't think that, oh, it's not going my way, it's not going smoothly, there's so many obstacles. Obviously, it's not right. Hashem doesn't will it. You know, we say it's b'shit. That's the wrong attitude, that even if there are difficulties, we have to push through them. And they, in fact, the difficulties indicate to us that it is right. Not that when it's going smoothly, is it telling us that it's right. It's more that if it's going difficult in a difficult way and in a challenging way, that should be an indication that this is correct, that this is what I'm supposed to be doing, that this is my opportunity to apply myself and to push through the difficulty and fulfill this mitzvah as a result of my effort. And so when the going gets tough, we should realize that actually it's a sign that we are on the cusp of greatness. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.